This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 13th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 404. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature. The book is called Ruta's Closet. It's the story of how a family's courage, love, and indomitable spirit triumphed over Nazi evil. It is the memoir of the late Ruth Krone Siegel. This week's guest is Keith Morgan, the former Vancouver Province reporter who authored Ruta's Closet with Siegel. It's a timely new edition of the book to help stop anti-Semitism in the aftermath of October 7th, 2023. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It is the story of how a family's courage, love, and indomitable spirit triumphed over Nazi evil. It is Ruta's Closet, the memoir of a Holocaust survivor from Lithuania, Ruth Krone Siegel. Siegel came to Canada in 1951 and made it her mission in life to tell the story of being Jewish when anti-Semitism swept across Europe. She died at age 72 in 2008. Former Province newspaper reporter Keith Morgan told her life story in the 2009 book, which was republished after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Now there is a rutascloset.com website, podcast series, and study guide. A new generation of British Columbians will learn about the Holocaust beginning this fall when it is finally added to the school curriculum. My guest on this edition of the podcast is Keith Morgan. Tell me about when you met Ruth and your first impressions of her, and how the feature series became the book, the latest edition out here in 2025.
97 it was. I was handed this new assignment, you know how it works in newspapers. We want you to write a column about your neighbors, people who make a difference here and overseas. So I was, of course, scrambling around for people, and a friend of the family actually came forth and said, oh, you should talk to Ruth Krone Siegel. She talks to youngsters about her Holocaust experience. It's a very interesting story. Now, that very moment, my teenage daughter at the time jumped up and said, oh, yes, I've heard her speak at the Vancouver Holocaust Education Center. She's very good. So that's a good hook, right? So straight away, I went to see her speak to children. And I was captivated by her approach, by her story. And, you know, covering the crime beat for some years, I'd seen and heard and written about all kinds of amazing things, mostly bad. But this story just spoke to me, and I thought, this really has to be told. Yes, Ruth's doing wonderful work speaking to youngsters like my daughter, but I'd like to spread this around. And so things happened. We talked, the features happened, and then one day she came up to me and said, hey, I'm going to reunite with a woman in Lithuania who was my rescuer. Would you like to come along? And those were the days in newspapers when we had money and could travel. And so I, of course, my boss said, go, go, go. So that was really the start of where it became so much bigger and was going to become a book. Because I was captivated by it. It was a story that needed to be told. And if I just may just go on a little bit longer about that, because I think it's interesting. Rob Krell, who's well known in this area at UBC, came to me. He was a friend of Ruth, and he said, I'm going to introduce you to somebody who will be very helpful in opening the doors to this story, because people in Lithuania are still in denial about their role in the Holocaust. And I said, oh, well, what's his name? And he said, Sir Martin Gilbert. Mm-hmm. Well, as a British schoolboy, you know, I thought, oh, Okay, went to meet him, and he told me straight away, he said, I'm familiar with your work as a crime reporter. And he said, this story deserves to be told in such a way that's going to go beyond the Jewish community. People need to hear this story. It's very dramatic. That should appeal to you as a newspaper guy. And so that was like a command. And he did. And that became the start of a friendship, my mentor, and he did open a lot of doors for me. That's where it went. And after it was published as a fundraiser, it became obvious that we should do more with it. And some years later, you've talked about what happened October 7th. That really spurred me on to say, this should be going worldwide, because it was not available worldwide before. And we need to do something more, podcast, etc. And so that's the way it's gone most recently, anyway.
Now, Lithuania had been for many, many years a good place for Jews. It had been called the Jerusalem of the North.
Yes.
And by 1939, 160,000 living in Lithuania. But how did it turn from a place that was welcoming for Jewish people in Northern Europe to a place that was part of the awful story of the Holocaust?
Well, it was over a period of years. The Russians always eyed the Baltic states as sort of theirs. Now, does that sound familiar to you? And they wanted to be in there, and indeed did take over. And that was not a great time either. But then there was a growing nationalist movement. The Lithuanian Activist Front was very fascist. They wanted the Nazis to come in and give them the chance to have their own national government again. That was not saying it was the start, but it was building. And they wanted rid of Jews, scapegoats, blame them for everything. We're familiar with that, of course. So it went from there. The Russians had the Molotov agreement, Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement, to respect each other's, the Nazis and land and their land. But then they basically moved in to attain government and Lithuania took over. And then, as we know, Hitler wanted to expand. He wanted room, Lebensraum, room for an expanding German public, broke the agreement, and that fateful day, June 22nd, 41, Operation Barbarossa started, and they invaded. Then what happened was the activist front became very active even before the Nazis took each town and started murdering Jews, taking over without any orders, as it were. And that was the real start of the Holocaust experience for Jews in Lithuania.
Now, Ruth was born in 1936, so she was very, very young as this happened, but learned to live within such difficult circumstances. There were incidents where Jews were ordered to wear the yellow star, Star of David, live under a curfew. Their property was seized and sold. The ghetto was sealed. This seemed to happen very slowly, but then things accelerated, as often happens in cases like this where dictatorships take over. How did she get through this?
Well, she did. As a quick background, she had a great life before the war. They were a successful professional parents and had a great time. But then all changed. They were all pushed into a ghetto. And what was interesting is initially, Ruth was telling me that even in the ghetto, initially, for children, they just roamed all day and played all day. So it seemed like a good time in some ways, waiting for parents to come back from the factory to be fed, but that was it. But of course, then it got worse and worse. And I think one of the standout moments to me was when she told me about how A man was being hanged for smuggling a little bit of food and cigarettes in, and they were all made to go and witness the hanging. Now, of course, that stuck with her for the rest of her life. Just one incident. There were many more. But of course, at that time, she, in some ways, she was guarded from what her parents were going through. Maya Krohn, her father, left an incredibly detailed diary, which I used as the basis for the book to be able to frame the story. So what Ruth couldn't remember or learned later, she was able to be guided also by that. And I basically traveled the world interviewing other survivors from the same ghetto, the Shabell ghetto, to get, you know, good old reporting, you know, well, what did you see? And they would tell me their versions of the stories, the hanging, and good conversations. You know, I was also able to go to the records of the Judenrat, that's the Jewish Council, and the notes were kept, the minutes. Does this take you back to City Hall? Yes, it does. The same kind of thing. And I'd done that in my earlier journalism. And so I was reading and poring over these records, which incidentally were buried after the war. They were buried, hidden from the Nazis, but found by the Russians, who used those records to prosecute after the war. So I was really fortunate. And then Sir Martin was incredibly helpful in finding people for me, advising me and warning me about matters. So I, you know, it was a good exercise in being able to chase down things. And, you know, I also, Google was just starting, and I was able to do a lot of research starting online. And, you know, as a fellow reporter, you know, spent some time doing police work, you follow every lead right down to the last thing. And I did that. And that, it's amazing what showed up. So I was able to pull together, I believe, a compelling read, which was horrific, but also inspirational, because we saw how a family got together and used all their resources and ingenuity to defeat Hitler. And one of the things I often say is when I talk to other survivors, I ask them how many grandchildren they've got. Find out so many of them have 10 and 12 grandchildren, and I see that as the great victory. And so there's that side of it. There were some horrible collaborators, which I write about in the book, but there were also rescuers, like the ones who read the teacher and his wife who rescued Ruth and kept her safe. And I found them, and I found I was able to interview Ruth's rescuer. Interesting there in that the first time I interviewed her, she was very wary because the Russians, they'd only just got independence, and she kept saying, the Russians are going to come back, they're going to come back. And so she was wary. The next time I saw was 2 or 3 years later, and she spoke more freely, because she was confident that the Russians weren't on the border and about to come back in. Sadly, that's something that Lithuanians and Latvians and Estonians are worried about yet again.
There must have been scars left over from experiencing that. I can't imagine as a child seeing those horrors, seeing an execution, for instance, with my own eyes, and what that might have done to me. But what did it do to Ruth, and how did she live with that through the rest of her life?
She coped remarkably well, I believe, in that her parents were incredibly supportive, as were other members of the family. But yes, they were there. It was with great regret for her entire life that she lost a little sister in a kinder action. Could she have done more? It haunted her. She'd go to survivor... Children of Survivor sessions around the world, and she'd go to the notice board and just have a look, just to see if maybe a sister had survived. That haunted her. She didn't say a great deal in her younger life, very typical, in fact, of Children of Survivors. But She watched what happened in the Balkans with the ethnic cleansing. She saw the Rwandan genocide. And this was a big wake-up call for her. She said, I have to talk to children because this could happen again. They need to be armed to watch what happened, to learn what happened, and to watch what to look out for, because it creeps in and people become scapegoats, Jews especially. They need to understand that. They need to be able to look at that kind of thing. So that's when she started to talk to young people, spoke to, well, thousands. So she was very willing when I came along to participate, to tell me everything she knew, her deepest feelings. And as you said, sadly, she died in 2008. The manuscript was finished. She looked at me and she took me by the hand. And she said, you are going to carry on telling my story when I'm gone, aren't you? And I said, well, of course I am. And I had the same thing with Sir Martin, you know, before he died. Carry on with this. It's important. People need to know. And he gave a chilling remark to me. He'd just been back to Lithuania to appear somewhere. And he said, you know what? This was, the early 2000s. He said, I was back there last month at the time. And he said, it doesn't take long scratching the surface to come across somebody who'll say, well, you know, they kind of got what they deserved. It's still there. And you know what? To this day, it's still there.
Ruth left a legacy in her work. She was director of the Women's Resource Center at the University of British Columbia, a job where she would have helped women take a step forward and other women help them take a step up in their lives in so many different ways. Did she talk much about her work there?
Not a great deal, other than it was very important to her. And, you know, she did see it as part of the same mission, you know, of enabling young women, of helping them, you know, making their own way. And she was dearly loved, you know.
And looking at history of what happens when anti-Semitism takes rise and what that does to communities as a real corrosive effect in so many different ways to people who aren't even Jewish, a corrosive effect to democracy. What do you think Ruth would say in the wake of October 7th, 2023, of what you're seeing on a daily basis?
She'd be absolutely horrified, and she'd be on the front line. You know, she always believed very much in education and specifically the young. Although, of course, as we know, it's not reserved for the young. You know, the growth in anti-Semitism covers all ages, I'm sorry to say, and we see it. I remember not long after October 7, you know, friends of mine in the Jewish community basically didn't go to work. They worked from home for a period of time because they were under threat. In our community here in Vancouver, I try not to get involved in the Well, I certainly don't get involved in the debates about whether Israel's gone too far in what it's doing in Gaza. I don't get into that. But what I do say is this, and that is to hold all Jews in the world collectively responsible for what a specific government is doing. Well, in this case, the Israeli government, obviously, is wrong. It's just plain wrong. I mean, it's racist. We would not hold every Muslim responsible for what Al-Qaeda's done or anybody else or what the Taliban is doing. It's preposterous. And so I try to frame it in that way. And I also try to encourage people to please look at the history of the Jews. You know, they have been around a few thousand years. And, you know, it's existential for them what's going on. And so I like to keep it on that level. Otherwise, you get a lot of abuse and a lot of erroneous information. There's plenty out there, as you know, you've also referred to. Please, you know, read this kind of book. I'm not the only one that's doing this. You know, see what went on, because there are clues all the way through. You see what's going on. But as I said, there's also hope in that you see people helping each other. You know, there are lots of stories. I just wanted to make sure that we expanded upon this. I mean, I'm not going to live forever, even though I eat well. You know, I'm not, you know, and so I want there to be a lasting legacy. And that's why we're talking about the podcast. We're recording a podcast which is based around Ruth, but we've tried to do something interesting with it in terms of using new media. We've got a newscast. I basically looked at every chapter of the book and its time, and I looked at what was happening elsewhere in the war. And so I wrote like a newscast, a kind of newscast that people would illicitly listen to in the ghetto with their, you know, their radios hidden away, which tells what was going on elsewhere. And I've got two old BBC buddies of mine from London who read the newscast just as they were, as though they were in the studio in the basement in London at the time. I've got some people in Kelowna, some radio people, like the guy who read it talks about movies that you can watch, documentaries, other things. His wife talks about books, and we're specializing in focusing, yes, on books for all ages, but we're trying to introduce children's books on this subject, because that's where we start. I'm also being interviewed by the producer every week, talking about the backstory, how I went about getting the story, because as you know, in your business, it's behind the scenes too that you learn a lot, and you learn about how I found out about things. And I'm telling stories that didn't make it into the book, you know, backstories. So we're doing that. And what we're also doing is occasionally, or more than occasionally, quite very often, interviewing people around the world who are leading innovative Holocaust awareness building projects all around the world. And they're bringing something different to it, what they're doing, how success they're having, all emphasizing the importance of education and awareness. As you said, it's becoming a compulsory component. It's been taught all over the province, various places, and some are better than others, obviously, but now it's compulsory. And so I saw this also as an opportunity. Wonders of Zoom, I can now speak to classes around the province. I can go visit. You know, that's the kind of thing we're doing and we're offering. But what I've also tapped into is, you know, book clubs around the world. This is the perfect book for people to read and meet and talk about what happened in that book, put themselves in that position. So we're doing that, and the website is there for people to respond to and let us know what they're thinking. Tell us their stories. And I know what will happen is I'll hear dozens more survivor stories worthy of telling and in doing interviews. So we go from there, but that's just the start. You know, we've got other ideas that we're doing, but we've got to get to the young.
Before we go, I've got to talk to you about your start. Now, you started off in newspapering back in 1975, Blackpool, England, and soccer fans in Vancouver will know Blackpool was where the great, late, great Tony Waiters played most of his career before finding his way to Vancouver,
Yeah. Working
the Whitecaps in 1977 and eventually taking Canada to its first World Cup in 1986. Now, before you're into newspapers, you were in the rock business. You worked with Judas Priest and Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
Black Sabbath, people are still talking about back to the beginning, the July 5th farewell concert, yes. The retirement for Ozzy Osbourne, playing solo and with Black Sabbath at Villa Park in Birmingham.
I'm pleased to say I'm still in touch with many of them. yes, it was, I came out of school and had this idiot idea of becoming a gravedigger. That was the trendy thing to do at the time. And then I realized I really liked music and I liked concerts. And I started putting concerts on illicitly because I couldn't sign a contract at age 16, but I did. And so I started putting concerts on in Blackpool. And gradually a guy from Birmingham came to me and said he wanted to headhunt me to go to Birmingham and work for Tony Iommi's agency and promote concerts for them and tour with bands. So that was an offer I couldn't refuse. So I went there and I found myself really hooked up with Judas Priest, and they were just in those formative years. So I toured around the country with them and went up into Scotland and that kind of thing. And got to tell you a quick story, that one of my favorite stories, my family's sick of hearing this, but one day in the office, this guy came in and they'll say, "Oh, so what are you up to now?" And he said, "Form this new band with Roy." And he said, "What we're doing is we're merging classical music with rock, and we're getting the gals from the Birmingham University Orchestra, the quartet string, and we're having them on stage and we're playing." And we're all saying to this guy, "Oh yeah, 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 sure you are. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sounds like a really good idea." And that was the birth of ELO. That was Jeff Lynne. and then we spent lots of time with Ozzy and the crew and went back to Geezer Butler's place during the week. So that was a fun time. But you know what? I got tired of it. I found that there was a lot of corruption. I'd turn up with Judas to collect money at the end of the gig, and they said, "Oh, we've already sent the money to head office." And I said, "Oh, really? I didn't know that." And I said, "Well, how much did you send?" And they'd say something like £125. Well, there was I, only supposed to collect 75. So Judas was getting ripped off. And I didn't like that. And I finally was in Scotland. And when I was in this community center, and the twits came in and broke all the cigarette machines and tried to steal the money, I thought, this is not for me. So I ran through the hall, through all of the bodies watching Priest, and I jumped on the stage, and bass player Ian Hill looked at me and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "We're all leaving by the back door, back the truck up to the back door." And I said, "And please drop me off at the station in Edinburgh, because I'm going back to Blackpool to become a reporter." And the story I wrote about this in the Province some years ago when I had a reunion with them here said, and I went to become a Cub reporter, and they went off to be millionaire tax exiles. So, yeah, so that was it. But I learned a little bit about marketing and promotions, and I brought that into my work as a journalist. And as you know, I did all kinds of things editorially that were new, and that's where I went from there, and I don't regret a moment. This is now, Ruth is now my, and her story is now my mission in life.
Well, nowadays, live performances are the bread and butter, and the actual musical product, the songs, the albums are secondary.
Yes. Yeah, that's completely switched around. I remember a couple of, how can I put this, memorable nights with The Who. Specifically with Keith Moon, which I have written about. And at that time, you know, you would all think they were huge, and they were, but they weren't making lots of money. They too were getting taken. And it's only in latter years that they really got what they deserved. And another good example is the Kinks, you know, monumental bands. Fortunately, they did get their worth. A friend of mine, John Fiddler, who was in a band called Medicine Head, and not well known here, had a number of hits in Britain. I remember him telling me a few years, quite recently, well, 10 years ago, telling me he now gets better money and royalties because of the way things are run now than he ever did. When he was actually recording. He's back on the road again, you know. And I remember doing having breakfast here, actually, with Paul Rodgers from Bad Company then. I remember it was with Free. But he was the same, you know. He said, hey, you know, it's a lot better now. The accounting's better, better management, you know. And of course, he's still playing, you know, still appearing. But at the ripe old age, I can't remember. I think he's about 76, 77. But that's great. I mean, I'm pleased that that happened. But for many, it didn't. For many, they just basically disappeared, and I dread to think about what happened to some.
Who is back on the road for the last time? They'll be coming through Vancouver on their, farewell tour.
This is the farewell tour, you know. But I got to let you into a little secret. We just talked about the great bands of yesteryear. I mean, will anybody think worse of me if I reveal that I am also a huge fan of the Pet Shop Boys? Because they blend the classical music that Chris Lowe from Blackpool, next door neighbor to my English teacher, merged with disco. And that's what I admire. It takes me back to when we were listening to classical music at school and think, oh, for goodness sake. And I keep thinking, somewhere Chris Lowe's teacher, if he's still around in Blackpool, is thinking, that's my lad. I taught him well, you know, but that's something I've passed on to my younger members of my family too. So there's my guilty secret. You know, I still love, mind you, they're both pensioners now themselves. So, you know.
That was Keith Morgan, former Vancouver Province reporter and the author of Ruta's Closet, the story of how a family's courage, love, and indomitable spirit triumphed over Nazi evil. Get more information by going to rutascloset.com.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw, Taiwan's exports rise for 20th straight month to new high in June, a new monthly high of $53.32 billion, marking a 33.7% increase from the previous year and the 20th consecutive month of growth, the Ministry of Finance reported. Artificial intelligence and high-performance computing continue to drive demand for related products. Concerns over U.S. tariffs ahead of the expiration of their suspension on July 9th also prompted customers to front-load shipments. Taiwan's exports to the United States totaled $17.27 billion. Exports to ASEAN countries, Japan and China and Hong Kong, rose by 28.2%, 25.3%, and 13.1%, respectively. In ABC News Australia, World Vision Australia CEO takes own charity to Fair Work after tenure ended. It comes after the organization told staff it had ended Daniel Wordsworth's tenure as chief and amid wider claims of a toxic workplace at the charity. Wordsworth was confirmed to be subject of bullying complaints, which World Vision independently investigated but were not substantiated. In Kyoto News, Japan opens Osprey base on Kyushu as China ramps up military presence. Operators at the new camp, staffed by about 420 personnel, began as safety concerns linger following a series of Osprey incidents in Japan and abroad, including a fatal crash 2 years ago. Some citizens gathered near the facility to voice opposition to the deployment. Ospreys can take off and land like helicopters, but cruise like airplanes. The relocation of the Ospreys reflects Tokyo's recent focus on bolstering deterrence and response capabilities in the southwestern Nansei Island chain, a strategically vital area due to its proximity to the potential geopolitical flashpoint of Taiwan. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the man who wants to kill vote by mail in Oregon contests a May election result. Ben Edel is working to save his job and change the way Oregonians cast their ballots. Edel is on the MAGA wing of Oregon's Republican Party and runs the public transit agency in Douglas County. He is the chief petitioner for a 2026 ballot initiative that would end Oregon's pioneering vote-by-mail system. He recently went to Washington, D.C. to meet with national GOP groups interested in funding his anti-vote-by-mail initiative. In Crosscut, free diaper program for low-income Washington families cut in half. In 2024, grant-funded organizations distributed more than 13 million baby products, but the new state budget will reduce access to these essentials. For the past 4 years, the program distributed $2.5 million annually in grants to organizations across Washington. Lawmakers trimmed nearly $3 billion in spending over the next 2 years to account for a $15 billion shortfall. In Washington, 31% of children are members of families below the federal poverty line, or $53,300 for a family of three in 2025. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. NDP quietly mandates defibrillators and naloxone for all BC schools. And Chief Justice calls time out at Lower Mainland BC Supreme Courts during World Cup in 2026. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the scientists, the techies, the workers, the farmers, the people who keep fields and gardens green and productive across British Columbia, especially in July, the peak month for water use. July is Smart Irrigation Month in British Columbia. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 13th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 13th of July in 1985, Live Aid in London and Philadelphia, the mega concerts for African famine relief? The day-long transatlantic televised charity concerts featured Queen, David Bowie, Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney, U2, The Who, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, Bryan Adams, Beach Boys, Simple Minds, Madonna, Tom Petty, Neil Young, and Bob Dylan, and many more. Here is Live Aid organizer Bob Yeldoff, the Boomtown Rats singer who once worked as a writer with Vancouver's Georgia Strait.
There is not enough money coming in, and all these people are not playing for the good of their health. They're playing for the good of other people's health. So get your money out now and phone up and give us the money. If you've got plenty of it, or if you've got none of it, get it to people who are dying of starvation. Get on the phone right now. There are 300 or 200 lines there. We want to get £1 million out of this country on the telephone before 10 o'clock tonight.
Live Aid eventually raised $127 million. And here is Bono, interviewed by the BBC on July 13th, 1985.
It's the government's responsibility, ultimately. I don't mean, I don't care whether Conservative, Labour or anything. It's the governments of our country's responsibility to look after our money, because we give them money in tax. And it seems to be an either-or situation. Either they invest in life or they invest in death. And, you know, for the cost of MX missiles or Star Wars or offensive defense budgets, we could turn those deserts in Africa into fertile land. I mean, the technology's with us. It is here, you know, it's possible to do it. So what I hope is this, as a public thing, will affect public opinion, which ultimately will affect the politicians and the policymakers.
Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.